It is not possible, Julia. I cannot conceive how the idea of attending the county ball can have entered your head after what's happened. Poor young Hattersley's dreadful death suffices to stop that. But, Aunt, Mr. Hattersley is no relation of ours. No relation, but you know that the poor fellow would not have shot himself if it had not been for you. Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, how can you say so, when the verdict was that he committed suicide, when in an unsound condition of mind? How could I help his blowing out his brains, when those brains were deranged? Julia, do not talk like this. If he did go off his head, it was you who upset him, by first drawing him on, leading him to believe that you liked him, and then throwing him over so soon as the Honorable James Lawler appeared on the scene. Consider, what will people say if you go to the assembly? What will they say if I do not go? They will immediately set it down to my caring deeply for James Hattersley, and they will think that there was some sort of engagement. They are not likely to suppose that. But really, Julia, you were for a while all smiles and encouragement. Tell me now, did Mr. Hattersley propose to you? Well, yes, he did, and I refused him. And then he went and shot himself in despair. Julia, you cannot with any face go to the ball. Nobody knows that he proposed, and precisely because I do go, everyone will conclude that he did not propose. I do not wish it to be supposed that he did. His family, of course, must have been aware. They will see your name among those present at the assembly. And they are in too great trouble to look at the paper to see who are at the dance. His terrible death lies at your door. How can you have the heart, Julia? I don't see it. Of course I feel it. I'm awfully sorry, and awfully sorry for his father, the Admiral. I cannot set him up again. I wish that when I rejected him, he had gone and done as did Joe Pomeroy, marry one of his landlady's daughters. There, Julia, is another of your delinquencies. You lured on young Pomeroy till he proposed, then you refused him, and in a fit of vexation and mortified vanity, he married a girl greatly beneath him in social position. If the menage proves a failure, you will have it on your conscience that you have wrecked his life, and perhaps hers as well. I cannot throw myself away as a charity to save this man or that from doing a foolish thing. What I complain of, Julia, is that you encouraged young Mr. Pomeroy till Mr. Hattersley appeared, whom you thought more eligible, and then you tossed him aside, and you did precisely the same with James Hattersley as soon as you came to know Mr. Lawler. After all, Julia, I'm not so sure that Mr. Pomeroy has not chosen the better part. The girl, I dare say, is simple, fresh, and affectionate. Your implication is not complimentary, Aunt Elizabeth. My dear, I have no patience with the young lady of the present day, who is shallow, self-willed, and indifferent to the feelings and happiness of others, who craves for excitement and pleasure, and desires nothing that is useful and good. Where now will you see a girl like Viola's sister, who let concealment, like a worm in the bud, feed on her damask cheek? Nowadays, a girl lays herself at the feet of a man if she likes him, turns herself inside out to let him and all the world read her heart. I have no relish to be like Viola's sister, and have my story, a blank. I never groveled at the feet of Joe Pomeroy or James Hattersley. No, but you led each to consider himself the favored one till he proposed, and then you refused him. It was like smiling at a man and then stabbing him to the heart. Well, I don't want people to think that James Hattersley cared for me. I certainly never cared for him, nor that he proposed. So I shall go to the ball. Julia Demant was an orphan. She had been retained at school till she was 18, and then had been removed, just at the age when a girl begins to take an interest in her studies and not to regard them as drudgery. On her removal, she had cast away all that she had acquired and had been plunged into the whirl of society. Then suddenly her father died. She had lost her mother some years before, and she went to live with her aunt, Miss Fleming. Julia had inherited a sum of about £500 a year and would probably come in for a good estate and funds as well on the death of her aunt. She had been flattered as a girl at home and at school as a beauty, and she certainly thought no small bones of herself. Miss Fleming was an elderly lady with a sharp tongue, very outspoken, and very decided in her opinions, but her action was weak, and Julia soon discovered that she could bend the aunt to do anything she willed, though she could not modify or alter her opinions. In the matter of Joe Pomeroy and James Hattersley, it was as Miss Fleming had said. Julia had encouraged Mr. Pomeroy and had only cast him off because she thought better of the suit of Mr. Hattersley, son of an admiral of that name. She had seen a good deal of young Hattersley, had given him every encouragement, had so entangled him that he was madly in love with her. And then, when she came to know the Honorable James Lawler and saw that he was fascinated, she rejected Hattersley with the consequences alluded to in the conversation above given. Julia was particularly anxious to be present at the county ball, for she had already been booked by Mr. Lawler for several dances, and she was quite resolved to make an attempt to bring him to a declaration. On the evening of the ball, Miss Fleming and Julia entered the carriage. The aunt had given way, as was her wont, but under protest. For about 10 minutes, neither spoke, and then Miss Fleming said, "Well, you know my feelings about this dance. I do not approve. I distinctly disapprove. I do not consider your going to the ball in good taste, or, as you would put it, in good form. Poor young Hattersley." "Oh, dear aunt, do let us put young Hattersley aside. He was buried with the regular forms, I suppose?" "Yes, Julia." "Then the rector accepted the verdict of the jury at the inquest. Why should not we? A man who is unsound in his mind is not responsible for his actions."
"I suppose not."
"Much less than I, who live 10 miles away." "I do not say that you are responsible for his death, but for the condition of mind that led him to do the dreadful deed. Really, Julia, you are one of those into whose head or heart only by surgical operation could the thought be introduced that you could be in the wrong. A hypodermic syringe would be too weak an instrument to effect such a radical change in you. Everyone else may be in the wrong, but you, never. As for me, I cannot get young Hattersley out of my head." "And I," retorted Julia with asperity, for her aunt's words had stung her, "I, for my part, do not give him a thought." She had hardly spoken the words before a chill wind began to pass around her. She drew the shawl that was over her bare shoulders closer about her and said, "Auntie, is the glass down on your side?"
"No, Julia, why do you ask?"
"There's such a draft."
"Draft? I do not feel one. Perhaps the window on your side hitches."
"Indeed, that is all right. It is blowing harder and is deadly cold. Can one of the front panes be broken?"
"No, Rogers would have told me had that been the case. Besides, I can see that they are sound."
The wind of which Julia complained swirled and whistled about her. It increased in force. It plucked at her shawl and slewed it about her throat. It tore at the lace on her dress. It snatched at her hair. It wrenched it away from the pins, the combs that held it in place. One long tress was lashed across the face of Miss Fleming. Then the hair, completely released, eddied up above the girl's head, and next moment was carried as a drift before her, blinding her. Then, a sudden explosion, as though a gun had been fired into her ear, and with a scream of terror she sank back among the cushions. Miss Fleming, in great alarm, pulled the check string, and the carriage stopped. The footman descended from the box and came to the side. The old lady drew down the window and said, "Oh, Phillips, bring the lamp. Something has happened to Miss DeMant." The man obeyed and sent a flood of light into the carriage. Julia was lying back, white and senseless. Her hair was scattered over her face, neck, and shoulders. The flowers that had been stuck in it, the pins that had fastened it in place, the pads that had given shape to the convolutions lay strewn, some on her lap, some in the rug at the bottom of the carriage. "Phillips," ordered the old lady in great agitation, "tell Rogers to turn the horses and drive home at once, and run as fast as you can for Dr. Crate." A few minutes after the carriage was again in motion, Julia revived. Her aunt was chafing her hand. "Oh, aunt," she said, "are all the glasses broken?"
"Broken? What glasses?"
"Those of the carriage, with the explosion."
"Explosion, my dear?"
"Yes, that gun which was discharged. It stunned me. Were you hurt?"
"I heard no gun, no explosion."
"But I did. It was as though a bullet had been discharged into my brain. I wonder that I escaped. Who can have fired at us?"
"My dear, no one fired. I heard nothing."
"I know what it was. I had the same experience many years ago. I slept in a damp bed and awoke stone deaf in my right ear. I remained so for 3 weeks. But one night, when I was at a ball and was dancing, all at once I heard a report as of a pistol in my right ear and immediately heard quite clearly again. It was wax."
"But, Aunt Elizabeth, I've not been deaf."
"You've not noticed that you were deaf."
"Oh, but look at my hair. It was that wind that blew it about."
"You're laboring under a delusion, Julia. There was no wind."
"But look, feel how my hair is down."
"That's been done by the motion of the carriage. There are many ruts in the road." They reached home, and Julia, feeling sick, frightened, and bewildered, retired to bed. Dr. Crate arrived, said that she was hysterical, and ordered something to soothe her nerves.
Julia was not convinced. The explanation offered by Miss Fleming did not satisfy her. That she was a victim to hysteria, she did not in the least believe. Neither her aunt, nor the coachman, nor Phillips had heard the discharge of a gun. As to the rushing wind, Julia was satisfied that she had experienced it. The lace was ripped, as by a hand, from her dress, and the shawl was twisted about her throat. Besides, her hair had not been so slightly arranged that the jolting of the carriage would completely disarrange it. She was vastly perplexed over what she had undergone. She thought and thought, but could get no nearer to a solution of the mystery. Next day, as she was almost herself again, she rose and went about as usual. In the afternoon, the Honorable James Lawler called and asked after Miss Fleming. The butler replied that his mistress was out making calls, but that Miss DeMant was at home and he believed was on the terrace. Mr. Lawler at once asked to see her. He did not find Julia in the parlor or on the terrace, but in a lower garden to which she had descended to feed the goldfish in the pond. "Oh, Miss DeMant," said he, "I was so disappointed not to see you at the ball last night. I was very unwell. I had a fainting fit and could not go. It threw a damp on our spirits. That is to say, on mine. I had you booked for several dances. You were able to give them to others. But that was not the same thing to me. I did an act of charity and self-denial. I danced instead with the ugly Miss Bergens and with Miss Pounding, and that was like dragging about a sack of potatoes. I believe it would have been a jolly evening, but for that shocking affair of young Hattersley, which kept some of the better sort away. I mean those who knew the Hattersleys. Of course, for me, that didn't matter. We were not acquainted. I never even spoke with the fellow. You knew him, I believe. I heard some people say so, and that you had not come because of him. The supper for a subscription ball was not atrociously bad. What did they say of me? Oh, if you will know, that you did not attend the ball because you liked him very much and were awfully cut up. I? What a shame that people should talk. I never cared a rush for him. He was nice enough in his way, not a bounder, but tolerable as young men go. Mr. Lawler laughed. I should not relish to have such a qualified estimate made of me. Nor need you. You are interesting. He became so only when he shot himself. It will be by this alone that he will be remembered. But there's no smoke without fire. Did he like you much? Dear Mr. Lawler, I'm not a clairvoyant and never was able to see into the brains or hearts of people, least of all young men. Perhaps it's fortunate for me that I cannot. One lady told me that he had proposed to you. Who was that, the potato sack? I will not give her name. Is there any truth in it, did he? No. At the moment she spoke, there sounded in her ear a whistle of wind, and she felt a current like a cord of ice creep round her throat, increasing in force and compression. Her hat was blown off, and the next instant a detonation rang through her head as though a gun had been fired into her ear. She uttered a cry and sank upon the ground. James Lawler was bewildered. His first impulse was to run to the house for assistance. Then he considered that he could not leave her lying on the wet soil, and he stooped to raise her in his arms and to carry her within. In novels, young men perform such a feat without difficulty, but in fact they are not able to do it, especially when the girl is tall and big-boned. Moreover, one in a faint is dead weight. Lawler staggered under his burden to the steps. It was as much as he could perform to carry her up to the terrace, and there he placed her on a seat. Panting and with his muscles quivering under the strain, he hastened to the drawing room, rang the bell, and when the butler appeared, he gasped, "Miss DeMant has fainted. You and I and the footman must carry her within." "She fainted last night in the carriage," said the butler. When Julia came to her senses, she was in bed, attended by the housekeeper and her maid. A few moments later, Miss Fleming arrived. "Oh, aunt, I've heard it again." "Heard what, dear?" "The discharge of a gun." "It's nothing but wax," said the old lady. "I'll drop a little sweet oil into your ear and then have it syringed with warm water." "I want to tell you something, in private." Miss Fleming signed to the servants to withdraw. "Aunt," said the girl, "I must say something. This is the second time that this has happened. I'm sure it's significant. James Lawler was with me in the sunken garden, and he began to speak about James Hattersley. You know it was when we were talking about him last night that I heard that awful noise. It was precisely as if a gun had been discharged into my ear. I felt as if all the nerves and tissues of my head were being torn and all the bones of my skull shattered, just what Mr. Hattersley must have undergone when he pulled the trigger. It was an agony for a moment, perhaps, but it felt as if it lasted an hour. Mr. Lawler had asked me point blank if James Hattersley had proposed to me, and I said no. I was perfectly justified in so answering, because he had no right to ask me such a question. It was an impertinence on his part, and I answered him shortly and sharply with a negative. But actually, James Hattersley proposed twice to me. He would not accept a first refusal, but came the next day bothering me again, and I was pretty curt with him. He made some remarks that were rude about how I had treated him, and which I will not repeat. And as he left, in a state of great agitation, he said, "Julia, I vow that you shall not forget this, and you shall belong to no one but me, alive or dead." I considered this great nonsense, and did not accord it another thought. But really, these terrible annoyances, this wind and the bursts of noise, do seem to me to come from him. It is just as though he felt a malignant delight in distressing me, now that he is dead. I should like to defy him, and I will do it if I can, but I cannot bear more of these experiences. They will kill me. Several days elapsed. Mr. Lawler called repeatedly to inquire, but a week passed before Julia was sufficiently recovered to receive him, and then the visit was one of courtesy and of sympathy, and the conversation turned upon her health and on indifferent themes. But some few days later it was otherwise. She was in the conservatory alone, pretty much herself again, when Mr. Lawler was announced. Physically, she had recovered, or believed that she had, but her nerves had actually received a severe shock. She had made up her mind that the phenomena of the circling wind and the explosion were in some mysterious manner connected with Hattersley. She bitterly resented this, but she was in mortal terror of a recurrence, and she felt no compunction for her treatment of the unfortunate young man, but rather a sense of deep resentment against him. If he were dead, why did he not lie quiet and cease from vexing her? To be a martyr was to her no gratification, for hers was not a martyrdom that provoked sympathy and which would make her interesting. She had hitherto supposed that when a man died, there was an end of him, his condition was determined for good or for ill. But that a disembodied spirit should hover about and make itself a nuisance to the living had never entered into her calculations. "Julia, if I may be allowed so to call you," began Mr. Lawler, "I brought you a bouquet of flowers. Will you accept them?" "Oh," she said, as he handed the bunch to her, "how kind of you. At this time of year they're so rare, and Aunt's gardener is so miserly that he will spare me none for my room but some miserable bits of geranium. It's too bad of you wasting your money like this upon me." "It's no waste if it affords you pleasure." "It is a pleasure. I dearly love flowers." "To give you pleasure," said Mr. Lawler, "is the great object of my life. If I could assure you happiness, if you would allow me to hope, to seize this opportunity, now that we are alone together." He drew near and caught her hand. His features were agitated, his lips trembled, there was earnestness in his eyes. At once a cold blast touched Julia and began to circle about her and to flutter her hair. She trembled and drew back. That paralyzing experience was about to be renewed. She turned deadly white and put her hand to her right ear. "Oh, James, James," she gasped. "Do not, pray do not speak what you want to say, or I shall faint. It is coming on. I'm not yet well enough to hear it. Write to me and I will answer. For pity's sake, do not speak it." Then she sank upon a seat, and at that moment her aunt entered the conservatory. On the following day, a note was put into her hand, containing a formal proposal from the Honorable James Lawler. And by return of post, Julia answered with an acceptance. There was no reason whatever why the engagement should be long, and the only alternative mooted was whether the wedding should take place before Lent or after Easter. Finally, it was settled that it should be celebrated on Shrove Tuesday. This left a short time for the necessary preparations. Miss Fleming would have to go to town with her niece concerning a trousseau, and a trousseau is not turned out rapidly any more than an armed cruiser. There is usually a certain period allowed to young people who have become engaged, to see much of each other, to get better acquainted with one another, to build their castles in the air, and to indulge in little passages of affection, vulgarly called spooning. But in this case, the spooning had to be curtailed and postponed. At the outset, when alone with James, Julia was nervous. She feared a recurrence of those phenomena that so affected her. But although every now and then the wind curled and soft about her, it was not violent, nor was it chilling, and she came to regard it as a wail of discomfiture. Moreover, there was no recurrence of the detonation, and she fondly hoped that with her marriage, the vexation would completely cease. In her heart was, deep down, a sense of exultation. She was defying James Hattersley and setting his prediction at naught. She was not in love with Mr. Lawler. She liked him in her cold manner and was not insensible to the social advantage that would be hers when she became the Honorable Mrs. Lawler. The day of the wedding arrived. Happily, it was fine. "Blessed is the bride the sun shines on," said the cheery Miss Fleming, "an omen, I trust, of a bright and unruffled life in your new condition." All the neighborhood was present at the church. Miss Fleming had many friends. Mr. Lawler had fewer present, as he belonged to a distant county. The church path had been laid with red cloth, the church decorated with flowers, and a choir was present to twitter the voice that breathed over Eden. The rector stood by the altar, and two cushions had been laid at the chancel step. The rector was to be assisted by an uncle of the bridegroom who was in holy orders. The rector, being old-fashioned, had drawn on pale gray kid gloves. First arrived the bridegroom with his best man, and stood in a nervous condition, balancing himself first on one foot, then on the other, waiting, observed by all eyes. Next entered the procession of the bride, attended by her maids, to the wedding march in Lohengrin on a wheezy organ. Then Julia and her intended took their places at the chancel step for the performance of the first portion of the ceremony, and the two clergy descended to them from the altar. "Wilt thou have this woman to thy wedded wife?" "I will." "Wilt thou have this man to thy wedded husband?" "I will." "I, James, take thee, Julia, to my wedded wife, to have and to hold," and so on. As the words were being spoken, a cold rush of air passed over the clasped hands, numbing them, and began to creep round the bride and to flutter her veil. She set her lips and knitted her brows. In a few minutes, she would be beyond the reach of these manifestations. When it came her turn to speak, she began firmly, "I, Julia, take thee, James." But as she proceeded, the wind became fierce. It raged about her. It caught her veil on one side and buffeted her cheek. It switched the veil about her throat, as though strangling her with a drift of snow contracting into ice. But she persevered to the end. Then James Lawler produced the ring, and was about to place it on her finger with the prescribed words, "With this ring I thee wed," when a report rang in her ear, followed by a heaving of her skull, as though the bones were being burst asunder, and she sank unconscious on the chancel step. In the midst of profound commotion, she was raised and conveyed to the vestry, followed by James Lawler, trembling and pale. He had slipped the ring back into his waistcoat pocket. Dr. Crate, who was present, hastened to offer his professional assistance. In the vestry, Julia rested in a Glastonbury chair, white and still, with her hands resting in her lap. And to the amazement of those present, it was seen that on the third finger of her left hand was a leaden ring, rude and solid, as though fashioned out of a bullet. Restoratives were applied, but full a quarter of an hour elapsed before Julia opened her eyes and a little color returned to her lips and cheeks. But as she raised her hands to her brow to wipe away the damp that had formed on it, her eye caught sight of the leaden ring, and with a cry of horror, she sank again into insensibility. The congregation slowly left the church, awestruck, whispering, asking questions, receiving no satisfactory answers, forming surmises, all incorrect. "I'm very much afraid, Mr. Lawler," said the rector, "that it will be impossible to proceed with the service today. It must be postponed till Miss DeMant is in a condition to conclude her part and assign the register. I do not see how it can be gone on with today. She's quite unequal to the effort." The carriage, which was to have conveyed the couple to Miss Fleming's house, and then later to have taken them to the station for their honeymoon, the horses decorated with white rosettes, the whip adorned with a white bow, had now to convey Julia, hardly conscious, supported by her aunt, to her home. No rice could be thrown. The bell ringers, prepared to give a joyous peal, were constrained to depart. The reception at Miss Fleming's was postponed. No one thought of attending. The cakes, the ices, were consumed in the kitchen. The bridegroom, bewildered, almost frantic, ran hither and thither, not knowing what to do, what to say. Julia lay as a stone for fully 2 hours, and when she came to herself, she could not speak. When conscious, she raised her left hand, looked on the leaden ring, and sank back again into senselessness. Not till late in the evening was she sufficiently recovered to speak, and then she begged her aunt, who had remained by her bed without stirring, to dismiss the attendants. She desired to speak with her alone. When no one was in the room with her, save Miss Fleming, she said in a whisper, "Oh, Aunt Elizabeth, oh, Auntie, such an awful thing has happened. I can never marry Mr. Lawler, never." I've married James Hattersley. I am a dead man's wife. At the time that James Lawler was making the responses, I heard a piping voice in my ear, an unearthly voice, saying the same words. When I said, I, Julia, take you, James, to my wedded husband, you know Mr. Hattersley is James, as well as Mr. Lawler, then the words applied to him as much or as well as to the other. And then when it came to the giving of the ring, there was the explosion in my ear as before, and the leaden ring was forced onto my finger, and not James Lawler's golden ring. It is of no use my resisting anymore. I am a dead man's wife, and I cannot marry James Lawler. Some years have elapsed since that disastrous day and that incomplete marriage. Miss Demant is Miss Demant still, and she has never been able to remove the leaden ring from the third finger of her left hand. Whenever the attempt has been made, either to disengage it by drawing it off or by cutting through it, there has ensued that terrifying discharge as of a gun into her ear, causing insensibility. The prostration that has followed, the terror it has inspired, have so affected her nerves that she has desisted from every attempt to rid herself of the ring. She invariably wears a glove on her left hand, and it is bulged over the third finger, where lies that leaden ring. She is not a happy woman, although her aunt is dead and has left her a handsome estate. She has not got many acquaintances. She has no friends, for her temper is unamenable and her tongue is bitter. She supposes that the world, as far as she knows it, is in league against her. Towards the memory of James Hattersley, she entertains a deadly hate. If an incantation could lay his spirit, if prayer could give him repose, she would have recourse to none of these expedients, even though they might relieve her, so bitter is her resentment. And she harbors a silent against Providence for allowing the dead to walk to molest the living. Church Peveril is a house so beset and frequented by specters, both visible and audible, that none of the family which it shelters under its acre and a half of green copper roofs takes psychical phenomena with any seriousness. For to the Peverils, the appearance of a ghost is a matter of hardly greater significance than is the appearance of the post to those who live in more ordinary houses. It arrives, that is to say, practically every day, it knocks or makes other noises, it is observed coming up the drive or in other places. I myself, when staying there, have seen the present Mrs. Peveril, who is rather short-sighted, peer into the dusk while we were taking our coffee on the terrace after dinner and say to her daughter, "My dear, was that not the blue lady who's just gone into the shrubbery? I hope she doesn't frighten Flo. Whistle for Flo, dear." Flo, it may be remarked, is the youngest and most precious of many Dotsons. Blanche Peveril gave a cursory whistle and crunched the sugar left unmelted at the bottom of her coffee cup between her very white teeth. "Oh, darling, Flo isn't so silly as to mind," she said. "Poor blue Aunt Barbara is such a bore. Whenever I meet her, she always looks as if she wanted to speak to me. But when I say, 'What is it, Aunt Barbara?' she never utters, but only points somewhere toward the house, which is so vague. I believe there was something she wanted to confess about 200 years ago, but she's forgotten what it is." Here, Flo gave two or three short, pleased barks and came out of the shrubbery wagging her tail and capering round what appeared to me to be a perfectly empty space on the lawn. "There, Flo has made friends with her," said Mrs. Peveril. "I wonder why she dresses in that very stupid shade of blue." From this, it may be gathered that even with regard to psychical phenomena, there is some truth in the proverb that speaks of familiarity. But the Peverils do not exactly treat their ghosts with contempt, since most of that delightful family never despised anybody, except such people as avowedly did not care for hunting or shooting or golf or skating. And as all of their ghosts are of their family, it seems reasonable to suppose that they all, even the poor blue lady, excelled at one time in field sports. So far, then, they harbor no such unkindness or contempt, but only pity. Of one Peveril, indeed, who broke his neck in vainly attempting to ride up the main staircase on a thoroughbred mare after some monstrous and violent deed in the back garden, they are very fond, and Blanche comes downstairs in the morning with an eye unusually bright when she can announce that Master Anthony was very loud last night. He, apart from the fact of his having been so foul a ruffian, was a tremendous fellow across country, and they like these indications of the continuance of his superb vitality. In fact, it is supposed to be a compliment, when you go to stay at Church Peveril, to be assigned a bedroom which is frequented by defunct members of the family. It means that you are worthy to look on the august and villainous dead, and you will find yourself shown into some vaulted or tapestried chamber without benefit of electric light, and you are told that great-great-grandmama Bridget occasionally has vague business by the fireplace, but it is better not to talk to her, and that you will hear Master Anthony awfully well if he attempts the front staircase any time before morning. There you are left for your night's repose, and, having quakingly undressed, begin reluctantly to put out your candles. It is drafty in these great chambers, and the solemn tapestry swings and bellows and subsides, and the firelight dances on the forms of huntsmen and warriors in stern pursuits. Then you climb into your bed, a bed so huge that you feel as if the desert of Sahara was spread for you, and pray, like the mariners who sailed with St. Paul, for day. And all the time, you are aware that Freddie and Harry and Blanche and possibly even Mrs. Peveril are quite capable of dressing up and making disquieting tappings outside your door, so that when you open it, some inconjecturable horror fronts you. For myself, I stick steadily to the assertion that I have an obscure valvular disease of the heart, and so sleep undisturbed in the new wing of the house, where Aunt Barbara and great-great-grandmama Bridget and Master Anthony never penetrate. I forget the details of great-great-grandmama Bridget, but she certainly cut the throat of some distant relation before she disemboweled herself with the axe that had been used at Agincourt. Before that, she had led a very sultry life, crammed with amazing incident. But there is one ghost at Church Peveril at which the family never laugh, in which they feel no friendly and amused interest, and of which they only speak just as much as is necessary for the safety of their guests. More properly, it should be described as two ghosts, for the haunt in question is that of two very young children, who were twins. These, not without reason, the family take very seriously indeed. The story of them, as told to me by Mrs. Peveril, is as follows. In the year 1602, the same being the last of Queen Elizabeth's reign, a certain Dick Peveril was greatly in favor at court. He was brother to Master Joseph Peveril, then owner of the family house and lands, who 2 years previously, at the respectable age of 74, became father of twin boys, firstborn of his progeny. It is known that the royal and ancient virgin had said to handsome Dick, who was nearly 40 years his brother's junior, "It's a pity that you are not master of Church Peveril," and these words probably suggested to him a sinister design. Be that as it may, handsome Dick, who very adequately sustained the family reputation for wickedness, set off to ride down to Yorkshire, and found that, very conveniently, his brother Joseph had just been seized with an apoplexy, which appeared to be the result of a continued spell of hot weather, combined with the necessity of quenching his thirst with an augmented amount of sack, and had actually died while handsome Dick, with God knows what thoughts in his mind, was journeying northwards. Thus it came about that he arrived at Church Peveril just in time for his brother's funeral. It was with great propriety that he attended the obsequies and returned to spend a sympathetic day or two of mourning with his widowed sister-in-law, who was but a faint-hearted dame, little fit to be mated with such hawks as these. On the second night of his stay, he did that which the Peverils regret to this day. He entered the room where the twins slept with their nurse and quietly strangled the latter as she slept. Then he took the twins and put them into the fire which warms the long gallery. The weather, which up to the day of Joseph's death had been so hot, had changed suddenly to bitter cold, and the fire was heaped high with burning logs and was exultant with flame. In the core of this conflagration, he struck out a cremation chamber, and into that he threw the two children, stamping them down with his riding boots. They could just walk, but they could not walk out of that ardent place. It is said that he laughed as he added more logs. Thus he became master of Church Peveril. The crime was never brought home to him, but he lived no longer than a year in the enjoyment of his blood-stained inheritance. When he lay dying, he made his confession to the priest who attended him, but his spirit struggled forth from its fleshly coil before absolution could be given him. On that very night, there began in Church Peveril the haunting, which to this day is but seldom spoken of by the family, and then only in low tones and with serious mien. For only an hour or two after Handsome Dick's death, one of the servants passing the door of the long gallery heard from within peals of the loud laughter, so jovial and yet so sinister, which he had thought would never be heard in the house again. In a moment of that cold courage, which is so nearly akin to mortal terror, he opened the door and entered, expecting to see he knew not what manifestation of him who lay dead in the room below. Instead, he saw two little white-robed figures toddling towards him hand in hand across the moonlit floor. The watchers in the room below ran upstairs, startled by the crash of his fallen body, and found him lying in the grip of some dread convulsion. Just before morning, he regained consciousness and told his tale. Then, pointing with trembling and ash-gray finger towards the door, he screamed aloud and so fell back dead. During the next 50 years, the strange and terrible legend of the twin babies became fixed and consolidated. Their appearance, luckily for those who inhabit the house, was exceedingly rare, and during these years they seemed to have been seen 4 or 5 times only. On each occasion they appeared at night, between sunset and sunrise, always in the same long gallery, and always as 2 toddling children, scarcely able to walk. And on each occasion, the luckless individual who saw them died, either speedily or terribly, or with both speed and terror, after the accursed vision had appeared to him. Sometimes he might live for a few months. He was lucky if he died, as did the servant who first saw them, in a few hours. Vastly more awful was the fate of a certain Mrs. Canning, who had the ill luck to see them in the middle of the next century, or to be quite accurate, in the year 1760. By this time, the hours and the place of their appearance were well known, and, as up till a year ago, visitors were warned not to go between sunset and sunrise into the long gallery. But Mrs. Canning, a brilliantly clever and beautiful woman, admirer also and friend of the notorious skeptic M. Voltaire, willingly went and sat, night after night, in spite of all protestations, in the haunted place. For 4 evenings she saw nothing, but on the 5th she had her will, for the door in the middle of the gallery opened, and there came toddling towards her the ill-omened, innocent little pair. It seemed that even then she was not frightened, but she thought good, poor wretch, to mock at them, telling them it was time for them to get back into the fire. They gave no word in answer, but turned away from her, crying and sobbing. Immediately after they disappeared from her vision and she rustled downstairs to where the family and guests in the house were waiting for her, with a triumphant announcement that she had seen them both and must needs write to M. Voltaire, saying that she had spoken to spirits made manifest, it would make him laugh. But when, some months later, the whole news reached him, he did not laugh at all. Mrs. Canning was one of the great beauties of her day, and in the year 1760 she was at the height and zenith of her blossoming. The chief beauty, if it is possible to single out one point where all was so exquisite, lay in the dazzling color and incomparable brilliance of her complexion. She was now just 30 years of age, but in spite of the excesses of her life, retained the snow and roses of girlhood, and she courted the bright light of day, which other women shunned, for it but showed to great advantage the splendor of her skin. In consequence, she was very considerably dismayed one morning, about a fortnight after her strange experience in the long gallery, to observe on her left cheek, an inch or two below her turquoise-colored eyes, a little grayish patch of skin, about as big as a 3-penny piece. It was in vain that she applied her accustomed washes and unguents. Vain, too, were the arts of her makeup and of her medical adviser. For a week she kept herself secluded, martyring herself with solitude and unaccustomed physics, and for a result at the end of the week she had no amelioration to comfort herself with. Instead, this woeful gray patch had doubled itself in size. Thereafter, the nameless disease, whatever it was, developed in new and terrible ways. From the center of the discolored place there sprouted forth little lichen-like tendrils of greenish-gray, and another patch appeared on her lower lip. This too soon vegetated, and one morning, on opening her eyes to the horror of a new day, she found that her vision was strangely blurred. She sprang to her looking-glass, and what she saw caused her to shriek aloud with horror. From under her upper eyelid a fresh growth had sprung up, mushroom-like, in the night, and its filaments extended downwards, screening the pupil of her eye. Soon after, her tongue and throat were attacked, the air passages became obstructed, and death by suffocation was merciful after such suffering. More terrible yet was the case of a certain Colonel Blantyre, who fired at the children with his revolver. What he went through is not to be recorded here. It is this haunting, then, that the Peverills take quite seriously, and every guest on his arrival in the house is told that the long gallery must not be entered after nightfall on any pretext whatever. By day, however, it is a delightful room and intrinsically merits description, apart from the fact that the due understanding of its geography is necessary for the account that here follows. It is full 80 feet in length and is lit by a row of 6 tall windows looking over the gardens at the back of the house. A door communicates with the landing at the top of the main staircase, and about halfway down the gallery, in the wall facing the windows, is another door communicating with the back staircase and servants' quarters, and thus the gallery forms a constant place of passage for them in going to the rooms on the first landing. It was through this door that the baby figures came when they appeared to Mrs. Canning, and on several other occasions they have been known to make their entry here, for the room out of which Handsome Dick took them lies just beyond at the top of the back stairs. Further on again in the gallery is the fireplace into which he thrust them, and at the far end a large bow window looks straight down the avenue. Above this fireplace there hangs, with grim significance, a portrait of Handsome Dick in the insolent beauty of early manhood, attributed to Holbein, and a dozen other portraits of great merit face the windows. During the day, this is the most frequented sitting room in the house, for its other visitors never appear there then, nor does it ever resound with the harsh, jovial laugh of Handsome Dick, which sometimes, after dark has fallen, is heard by passers-by on the landing outside. But Blanche does not grow bright-eyed when she hears it. She shuts her ears and hastens to put a greater distance between her and the sound of that atrocious mirth. But during the day, the long gallery is frequented by many occupants, and much laughter in no wise sinister or saturnine resounds there. When summer lies hot over the land, those occupants lounge in the deep window seats, and when winter spreads his icy fingers and blows shrilly between his frozen palms, congregate round the fireplace at the far end, and perch, in companies of cheerful chatterers, upon sofa and chair back and floor. Often have I sat there on long August evenings up until dressing time, but never have I been there when anyone has seemed disposed to linger over late without hearing the warning, "It is close on sunset, shall we go?" Later on, in the shorter autumn days, they often have tea laid there, and sometimes it has happened that even while merriment was most uproarious, Mrs. Peveril has suddenly looked out of the window and said, "My dears, it's getting so late. Let us finish our nonsense downstairs in the hall." And then for a moment, a curious hush always falls on loquacious family and guests alike, and as if some bad news had just been known, we all make our silent way out of the place. But the spirits of the Peverils, of the living ones, that is to say, are the most mercurial imaginable, and the blight which the thought of Handsome Dick and his doings casts over them passes away again with amazing rapidity. A typical party, large, young, and peculiarly cheerful, was staying at Church Peveril shortly after Christmas last year, and as usual on December 31st, Mrs. Peveril was giving her annual New Year's Eve ball. The house was quite full, and she had commandeered as well the greater part of the Peveril Arms to provide sleeping quarters for the overflow from the house. For some days past, a black and windless frost had stopped all hunting, but it is an ill windlessness that blows no good, if so mixed a metaphor may be forgiven, and the lake below the house had, for the last day or two, been covered with an adequate and admirable sheet of ice. Everyone in the house had been occupied all the morning of that day in performing swift and violent maneuvers on the elusive surface. And as soon as lunch was over, we all, with one exception, hurried out again. This one exception was Madge Dalrymple, who had had the misfortune to fall rather badly earlier in the day, but hoped, by resting her injured knee, instead of joining the skaters again, to be able to dance that evening. The hope, it is true, was the most sanguine sort, for she could but hobble ignobly back to the house, but with the breezy optimism which characterizes the Peverils, she is Blanche's first cousin, she remarked that it would be but tepid enjoyment that she could, in her present state, derive from further skating, and thus she sacrificed little, but might gain much. Accordingly, after a rapid cup of coffee, which was served in the long gallery, we left Madge comfortably reclined on the big sofa at right angles to the fireplace, with an attractive book to beguile the tedium till tea. Being of the family, she knew all about Handsome Dick and the babies, and the fate of Mrs. Canning and Colonel Blantyre. But as we went out, I heard Blanche say to her, "Don't run it too fine, dear," and Madge had replied, "No, I'll go away well before sunset," and so we left her alone in the long gallery. Madge read her attractive book for some minutes, but failing to get absorbed in it, put it down and limped across to the window. Though it was still but a little after two, it was but a dim and uncertain light that entered, for the crystalline brightness of the morning had given place to a veiled obscurity produced by flocks of thick clouds, which were coming sluggishly up from the northeast. Already the whole sky was overcast with them, and occasionally a few snowflakes fluttered waveringly down past the long windows. From the darkness and bitter cold of the afternoon, it seemed to her that there was like to be a heavy snowfall before long, and these outward signs were echoed inwardly in her by that muffled drowsiness of the brain, which to those who are sensitive to the pressures and lightness of weather portends storm. Madge was peculiarly the prey of such external influences. To her, a brisk morning gave an ineffable brightness and briskness of spirit, and correspondingly the approach of heavy weather produced a somnolence and sensation that both drowsed and depressed her. It was in such mood as this that she limped back again to the sofa beside the log fire. The whole house was comfortably heated by water pipes, and though the fire of logs and peat, an adorable mixture, had been allowed to burn low, the room was very warm. Idly, she watched the dwindling flames, not opening her book again, but lying on the sofa with face towards the fireplace, intending drowsily and not immediately to go to her own room and spend the hours until the return of the skaters made gaiety in the house again in writing one or two neglected letters. Still drowsily, she began thinking over what she had to communicate. One letter, several days overdue, should go to her mother, who was immensely interested in the psychical affairs of the family. She would tell her how Master Anthony had been prodigiously active on the staircase a night or two ago, and how the Blue Lady, regardless of the severity of the weather, had been seen by Mrs. Peveril that morning strolling about. It was rather interesting. The Blue Lady had gone down the Laurel Walk and had been seen by her to enter the stables, where, at the moment, Freddie Peveril was inspecting the frostbound hunters. Identically, then, a sudden panic had spread through the stables, and the horses had whinnied and kicked and shied and sweated. Of the fatal twins, nothing had been seen for many years past, but, as her mother knew, the Peverils never used the long gallery after dark. Then for a moment she sat up, remembering that she was in the long gallery now. But it was still but a little after 2:30, and if she went to her room in 30 minutes, she would have ample time to write this and another letter before tea. Till then, she would read her book. But she found she had left it on the windowsill, and it seemed scarcely worthwhile to get it. She felt exceedingly drowsy. The sofa where she lay had been lately recovered, in a grayish-green shade of velvet, somewhat the color of lichen. It was a very thick, soft texture, and she luxuriously stretched her arms out, one on each side of her body, and pressed her fingers into the nap. How horrible that story of Mrs. Canning was! The growth on her face was the color of lichen. And then, without further transition or blurring of thought, Madge fell asleep. She dreamed. She dreamed that she awoke and found herself exactly where she had gone to sleep, and in exactly the same attitude. The flames from the logs had burned up again and leaped on the walls, fitfully illuminating the picture of Handsome Dick above the fireplace. In her dream, she knew exactly what she had done today, and for what reason she was lying here now, instead of being out with the rest of the skaters. She remembered also, still dreaming, that she was going to write a letter or two before tea, and prepared to get up in order to go to her room. As she half rose, she caught sight of her own arms lying out on each side of her on the gray velvet sofa. But she could not see where her hands ended and where the gray velvet began. Her fingers seemed to have melted into the stuff. She could see her wrists quite clearly and a blue vein on the backs of her hands, and here and there a knuckle. Then, in her dream, she remembered the last thought which had been in her mind before she fell asleep, namely the growth of the lichen-colored vegetation on the face and the eyes and the throat of Mrs. Canning. At that thought, the strangling terror of real nightmare began. She knew that she was being transformed into this gray stuff, and she was absolutely unable to move. Soon the gray would spread up her arms and over her feet. When they came in from skating, they would find here nothing but a huge misshapen cushion of lichen-colored velvet, and that would be she. The horror grew more acute, and then by a violent effort she shook herself free of the clutches of this very evil dream, and she awoke. For a minute or two she lay there, conscious only of the tremendous relief at finding herself awake. She felt again with her fingers the pleasant touch of the velvet, and drew them backwards and forwards, assuring herself that she was not, as her dream had suggested, melting into grayness and softness. But she was still, in spite of the violence of her awakening, very sleepy, and lay there till, looking down, she was aware that she could not see her hands at all. It was very nearly dark. At that moment a sudden flicker of flame came from the dying fire, and a flare of burning gas from the peat flooded the room. The portrait of Handsome Dick looked evilly down on her, and her hands were visible again. And then a panic worse than the panic of her dream seized her. Daylight had altogether faded, and she knew that she was alone in the dark in the terrible gallery. This panic was of the nature of nightmare, for she felt unable to move for terror. But it was worse than nightmare, because she knew she was awake. And then the full cause of this frozen fear dawned on her. She knew with the certainty of absolute conviction that she was about to see the twin babies. She felt a sudden moisture break out on her face, and within her mouth her tongue and throat went suddenly dry, and she felt her tongue grate along the inner surface of her teeth. All power of movement had slipped from her limbs, leaving them dead and inert, and she stared with wide eyes into the blackness. The spurt of flame from the peat had burned itself out again, and darkness encompassed her. Then, on the wall opposite her, facing the windows, there grew a faint light of dusky crimson. For a moment, she thought it but heralded the approach of the awful vision. Then hope revived in her heart, and she remembered that thick clouds had overcast the sky before she went to sleep, and guessed that this light came from the sun, not yet quite sunk and set. This sudden revival of hope gave her the necessary stimulus, and she sprang off the sofa where she lay. She looked out of the window and saw the dull glow on the horizon. But before she could take a step forward, it was obscured again. A tiny sparkle of light came from the hearth, which did no more than illuminate the tiles of the fireplace, and snow falling heavily tapped at the window panes. There was neither light nor sound except these. But the courage that had come to her, giving her the power of movement, had not quite deserted her, and she began feeling her way down the gallery. And then she found that she was lost. She stumbled against a chair, and recovering herself, stumbled against another. Then a table barred her way, and turning swiftly aside, she found herself up against the back of a sofa. Once more she turned and saw the dim gleam of the firelight on the side opposite to that on which she expected it. In her blind groping, she must have reversed her direction. But which way was she to go now? She seemed blocked in by furniture, and all the time insistent and imminent was the fact that the two innocent, terrible ghosts were about to appear to her. Then she began to pray. "Lighten our darkness, O Lord," she said to herself. But she could not remember how the prayer continued, and she had sore need of it. There was something about the perils of the night. All this time she felt about with her groping, fluttering hands. The fire glimmer, which should have been on her left, was on her right again. Therefore she must turn herself round again. "Lighten our darkness," she whispered, and then aloud she repeated, "Lighten our darkness." She stumbled up against a screen and could not remember the existence of any such screen. Hastily she felt beside it with blind hands and touched something soft and velvety. Was it the sofa on which she had lain? If so, where was the head of it? It had a head and a back and feet. It was like a person, all covered with gray lichen. Then she lost her head completely. All that remained to her was to pray. She was lost, lost in this awful place, where no one came in the dark except the babies that cried. And she heard her voice rising from whisper to speech and speech to scream. She shrieked out the holy words. She yelled them as if blaspheming as she groped among tables and chairs and the pleasant things of ordinary life which had become so terrible. Then came a sudden and an awful answer to her screamed prayer. Once more a pocket of inflammable gas in the peat on the hearth was reached by the smoldering embers, and the room started into light. She saw the evil eyes of Handsome Dick. She saw the little ghostly snowflakes falling thickly outside. And she saw where she was, just opposite the door through which the terrible twins made their entrance. Then the flame went out again and left her in blackness once more. But she had gained something, for she had her geography now. The center of the room was bare of furniture, and one swift dart would take her to the door of the landing above the main staircase and into safety. In that gleam, she had been able to see the handle of the door, bright brassed, luminous like a star. She would go straight for it. It was but a matter of a few seconds now. She took a long breath, partly of relief, partly to satisfy the demands of her galloping heart. But the breath was only half taken when she was stricken once more into the immobility of nightmare. There came a little whisper, it was no more than that, from the door opposite which she stood and through which the twin babies entered. It was not quite dark outside it, for she could see that the door was opening. And there stood in the opening two little white figures, side by side. They came towards her, slowly, shufflingly. She could not see face or form at all distinctly, but the two little white figures were advancing. She knew them to be the ghosts of terror, innocent of the awful doom they were bound to bring, even as she was innocent. With the inconceivable rapidity of thought, she made up her mind what to do. She had not hurt them or laughed at them, and they were but babies when the wicked and bloody deed had sent them to their burning death. Surely the spirits of these children would not be inaccessible to the cry of one who was of the same blood as they, who had committed no fault that merited the doom they brought. If she entreated them, they might have mercy. They might forbear to bring the curse on her. They might allow her to pass out of the place without blight, without the sentence of death, or the shadow of things worse than death upon her. It was but for the space of a moment that she hesitated. Then she sank down on her knees. and stretched out her hands towards them. "Oh, my dears," she said, "I only fell asleep. I've done no more wrong than that." She paused a moment, and her tender girl's heart thought no more of herself, but only of them, those little innocent spirits on whom so awful a doom was laid, that they should bring death where other children bring laughter, and doom for delight. But all those who had seen them before had dreaded and feared them, or had mocked at them. Then, as the enlightenment of pity dawned on her, her fear fell from her like the wrinkled sheath that holds the sweet folded buds of spring. "Dears, I am so sorry for you," she said. "It is not your fault that you must bring me what you must bring, but I am not afraid any longer. I am only sorry for you. God bless you, you poor darlings." She raised her head and looked at them. Though it was so dark, she could now see their faces, though all was dim and wavering, like the light of pale flames shaken by a draft. But the faces were not miserable or fierce. They smiled at her with shy little baby smiles. And as she looked, they grew faint, fading slowly away like wreaths of vapor in frosty air. Madge did not at once move when they had vanished, for instead of fear, there was wrapped round her a wonderful sense of peace, so happy and serene that she would not willingly stir, and so perhaps disturb it. But before long she got up, and feeling her way, but without any sense of nightmare pressing her on, or frenzy of fear to spur her, she went out of the long gallery, to find Blanche just coming upstairs, whistling and swinging her skates. "How's the leg, dear?" she asked. "You're not limping anymore." Till that moment, Madge had not thought of it. "I think it must be all right," she said. "I had forgotten it anyhow. Blanche, dear, you won't be frightened for me, will you? But I've seen the twins." For a moment, Blanche's face whitened with terror. "What?" she said in a whisper. "Yes, I saw them just now. But they were kind, they smiled at me, and I was so sorry for them. And somehow I'm sure I have nothing to fear." It seems that Madge was right, for nothing has come to touch her. Something, her attitude to them, we must suppose, her pity, her sympathy, touched and dissolved and annihilated the curse. Indeed, I was at Church Peveril only last week, arriving there after dark. Just as I passed the gallery door, Blanche came out. "Ah, there you are," she said. "I've just been seeing the twins. They looked too sweet and stopped nearly 10 minutes. Let us have tea at once."